Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Camilla Donahue and I'm off to get my colours done. Joining me is author and Dalgy Harrison Ford lookalike you meet in Thailand, Aisha Malik.
Hello.
I just did the really Irish thing of saying Thailand.
That's okay.
It's a weird thing that we do.
Yeah, we don't do that. We do Thailand.
Oh, you kind of pronounce the H too.
Like yeah. The film thing.
Yeah.
We have the film thing in common, right?
Just one of the many, many...
many similarities.
Between Pakistani people and Irish people,
exactly.
Which is the root of our friendship.
Absolutely.
So today we're talking about Bridget Jones at the Edge of Reason, the sequel to Bridget Jones. And obviously you came here and did, for our first season many years ago, you did the original Bridget Jones. And so it's very nice to be revisiting the second one with you.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yeah, like what are our initial impressions on rereading this fantastic, fucking hilarious book?
I was just going to ask whether I'm allowed to swear. Of course I'm allowed to swear. I'm on Sentimental Garbage.
We're a cool podcast.
Yeah, man. I fucking love the second book and I love it more than the first one. And I reread it a few times, but this time I listened to the Audible, which was really fun because I didn't actually feel like I had to do anything active to take it all in.
And I remember you saying last time that you actually read this book before you read the first one.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I did actually. And I'd completely forgotten about that. So thanks for reminding me. Yeah, that's what made me read the first one. I just love this book. But I found Bridget slightly annoying at times because she's so fucking thick.
She's so fucking thick.
She's so fucking stupid. You kind of hate her and love her for it at the same time.
Yeah, I feel like she is dumber in this book than the last one.
That might be the case. Or maybe because we're older and perhaps wiser, her absolute lack of wisdom is more pronounced.
The thing is that when she's like a little thick, I love it so much. Like the thing when she doesn't know where Germany is. When Tom bumps into Daniel Cleaver at a club and then he said, "Why are you so horrible to Bridget?" And Daniel Cleaver says, "How could I go out with someone who doesn't know where Germany is?"
I did in my head think, "Do I know where Germany is?"
I had such a Germany dysmorphia. I was like...
I had to Google just to make sure I knew the... you know, vague whereabouts of Germany. It was okay.
It was fine. We were okay. We all
yeah,
know
it was
it's
okay. Yeah.
Next to France.
Yes. And Switzerland somewhere in the mix.
But then when she, like, so that kind of thickness, I find
it's cute.
Very cute.
Totally adorable.
But then.
The relationship thickness.
Hard to manage, particularly in the opening chapters.
Particularly when her two best friends are equally thick and
yeah.
give her really actually bad advice.
It's quite hard. The bits where she was... this book begins... actually, I'm just going to do a quick plot summary while we're here, just to get the business out of the way. The Edge of Reason picks up where Bridget Jones left off, with Bridget and Mark happily together and in love. However, Bridget's insecure addiction to self-help, as well as her scheming frenemy, Rebecca, quickly break Mark and Bridget up. Edge of Reason follows Bridget's adventures as she is locked up in a Thai prison, is sent death threats by her builder, and continues to be tortured by her parents and the smug marrieds of her life. So we open and they're together, and like, I think it's so cute the way it opens because she's staring at him so he'll wake up and ask her about her opinions.
Because her opinions are so refined.
I love how we never find out what her opinions are, just that Mark thinks they're very unique.
Yeah, no, it's very cute. And actually, I love Mark Darcy in it.
Yeah, he's really
more so
cute
than I thought I would.
Yeah, yeah, he's...
in a kind of way that's slightly unbelievable.
Yes, it is very romantic hero. Like, his personality is saving legal, complicated legal situations that Bridget is in, and talking about her in a nice way to people who aren't her, that she overhears.
And also just popping up whenever she's in need.
Yeah.
Miraculously.
He's a very deus machina.
Yes, he is.
His one like lone personality trait is being awkward at parties and liking Newcastle United.
Yeah. Which makes him human. And I'm pretty sure that Helen Fielding's editor probably told her to stick something in to make him feel relatable.
Yeah, less like just this papa.
Yeah.
Precisely. So it's very cute when she's just like, you know, she's all loved up with him and stuff. But obviously, Bridget can't stay happy for very long because...
She's thick.
She's thick and we need drama because we're thick.
Also.
And the whole opening, like, I'm going to say fifth of the book is just her putting two and two together and making 16,000.
Yeah.
And then her friends encouraging her that it is 16,000.
Yeah.
And then her destroying her relationship with Mark. And it's actually quite hard to watch.
Yeah. Especially when you consider that she is how old is she in this? Like 33, 34?
Yeah.
You kind of have a feeling that someone at that age should have got their shit together a bit by this stage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Magda, on the other hand, is probably her only sensible friend.
Yeah, which is like annoying because it's that thing of like someone who, you know, the married friend is the only person who has any lick of sense.
Or she managed to get married because she has some sense.
Or that. Sorry. Yeah. But there's this thing when she like, you know, they go to 192, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Which, did you know what 192 was?
I have no idea.
So they're constantly talking about going to 192. And then I realized, I did some research, it's a... restaurant from the 90s that was in Notting Hill that in the mid 90s was like super, oh my god, like Tom Cruise is here, lots of celebrities,
really?
Like the original kind of she British restaurant and
all
that. And then by the time this book is set, which is I think 1998,
because Diana,
I think it was starting to go out of fashion, which is why Bridget's obviously obsessed with it.
Oh, I see.
And
is it still around?
No, it closed. Mm. Yeah. Sadly. There's lots of like Guardian odes to it.
Oh, really?
Which really shows you what kind of market's left on society. But it's them constantly in 192, and like there's a scene where she's like, oh, everything's great with Mark. He's lovely. He's lovely to me. I love him. And everyone's really annoyed because obviously their whole thing as this urban family is that they're all single together. And then she goes, but... And then she mentions this tiny thing about him bumping into Rebecca. And then they obviously blow it all out of proportion.
Yeah.
And then even though Rebecca is trying to steal him, they kind of make her believe that Mark is willing to be stolen, you know?
Yeah, they're really actually... When I read... or listen to that bit, I was like, they're actually really bad friends.
Yeah, I was really hating them for the first sort of third.
Yeah, me too. And then somehow it saved itself, didn't it, in some way or another, because they're also just thick. And you know, sometimes you can't blame someone for being stupid.
I know, and there's like this thing, you certainly can't. Yeah, write that down on a piece of paper and keep it in my wallet.
Very wise.
The thing of like, you're really frustrated with her friends at the beginning and you really feel for Mark because he's like, I'm just trying to have a date with you, and you keep like taking phone calls to put out your friends' stupid dramas about their stupid boyfriends.
Although I was really annoyed about the bit where he's walking with Rebecca in their her beautiful country house.
Yeah.
And he starts complaining about these self-help books and her friends. And I got a bit prickly because I was like, don't complain about her friends.
Yeah.
They were there way before you were, love.
Exactly.
You know?
And you don't have any friends.
Yes, you don't have, for obvious reasons.
Because men in their 30s.
Terrible cold fish.
Terrible cold fish, and men in their 30s don't have friends.
Oh, really? Is
no,
that a fact?
That's a fact.
You heard it here first, people.
It's really hard for them. They have grim friendships. But then you spend the kind of first bit being quite annoyed by them. But then when Bridget goes through all that stuff, being in prison in Thailand and all that, you're like, oh, they do come through for her. And there's a reason they're so dependent on each other, because they're all each other have.
Yes, they're not malicious.
Yeah.
That's the nice thing. And they are. One thing I loved about Bridget, actually, even though she is irrevocably stupid, is that she's also incredibly kind.
Yeah.
And so empathetic and always there for people, for Giles.
I love the Giles stuff.
For the man who, you know, almost shoots her via a pen, Gary.
Gary the builder.
You know, she's just always sees the best in people. And you know what? I feel like we need more of that.
She's such a live, laugh, love, hun.
She is. Even when she's in the Thai prison, she's like, you know what? I'm just going to sing Madonna.
Yeah.
It's shit. I'm going to have a breakdown, but it will only last about 35 seconds.
The thing is, she's so kind. And I really feel like, because I've known her my whole life.
Yes, she's our closest friend.
She's our closest friend. And like, I feel like I'm defending her to like, not as a literary figure, but as a person that people are mean about.
Yes.
Like my dear friend. And I'm like, yeah, she is thick as shit. And she does destroy every relationship she has. And she's probably quite bad at her job. But she's so kind and she's so resilient.
She is. She is.
I was texting you at like midnight last night when I was finishing it. I was like, I'm just so proud of Bridget for how she handled herself in the Thai prison.
Yes, me too. I felt that her eternal optimism is something that we could all do with.
Yeah. You know? I love the Thailand stuff so much.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's actually brilliant. The whole book is, you know, it teeters on the slightly ridiculous side, you know, the boy that with the bunny in Mark Darcy's room and...
Oh my God, let's just talk about... Sorry, we're jumping all around the place, but there's so much event.
We're not being very linear with this, are we?
So the first time she goes to Mark Darcy's house in Holland Park, which I can see so clearly with like everything looks like a robot, everything's metal. She can't find any light switches. She goes upstairs and there's
a young
the son of his Filipino cleaner
is foreshadowing sitting, there
yeah of Southeast Asia, yes. there's a weird ethnocentric vibe to this, like
with Wellington,
but
we'll get to Wellington.
So she in her, the cleaner's son is sitting on the bed with a rabbit and some wooden balls.
Is it dead or alive, the rabbit?
Never clarified. I also wondered that. Mm. And she's like, oh no, of course Mark Darcy is a sex pest. And then she bolts from the house and doesn't take any of his calls and refuses to hear any reasoning. And then he just calls her like a day later and he's like, I realise that it was upsetting for you, but I just had to talk down... My cleaner.
Whose son is schizophrenic.
Whose son is apparently... And, like, we never hear about it again.
No. I think he got rid of that housekeeper.
What was that about? It's such a weird thing
Do you think Helen Fielding was just trying to just be as outrageous as possible?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's a lot of outrageous stuff that happens. There's that, and then there's the whole Wellington coming to the UK and getting a jet ski and then going back to Africa. I forget where in Africa.
Kenya.
And then you've got the Gary the Builder leaving a hole in the wall.
Yeah.
And the rotting meat in the hole in the wall. And then you've got him sending her a bullet via a pen with her name on it.
She thinks it's a lipstick. Or an invite to a party.
Which, by the way, is a really hilarious stream of consciousness.
So funny when she finds it.
Yeah, it's very funny. The whole book is actually hilarious.
It's just so funny.
It's just clever funny. It's not necessarily slapstick funny. And it is in parts, but slapstick funny. But it's just very clever about human foibles.
Yes, and how people really react to things, like the slow dawning of the bullet thing of like, first you're thinking it's like some kind of a PR thing, because the thing is, you would. If you're like a London media hun, which I am, and you are, and I received like a weird sort of like thing like that.
Yeah.
And it was the late 90s, which is sort of the PR boom of like mental party invites.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh, someone's thought of me.
This is nice. Which literature festival sent this to me? Maybe it's for that panel I'm doing this week. Yeah, no, it's very funny. The whole being shot with a pen. That's a bullet.
It's just... But, like, the thing is that it's so obvious that Helen Fielding was just throwing all the plot spaghetti at the book wall.
But she was fucking having fun. Yeah. She was like, you know what? My first book was a huge hit. I'm going to do whatever the fuck I want with the second one. And it worked.
I'm just going to plonk her in these mental situations.
Yeah.
And have her respond the way. It's that thing of when an author knows their character so well and they can put them anywhere in the world, in any situation, and they know exactly how they're going to react.
Yeah.
It's almost like Alan Partridge. It's like Steve Coogan knows Alan Partridge so well that he can put them in any sort of format and he just knows, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
And that's what the sort of magic of the character is all about. But if it was just like, and I just wrote a sequel and they are so fucking difficult.
They're the worst.
You did it? Oh my god, you did it as well.
I did it as well. The sequel is... I think the second book syndrome is a real thing.
Second book syndrome is definitely a real thing.
And the sequel...
syndrome.
Yeah, is really difficult.
Because you sit down to write and all you can think about is every single time you've ever heard someone say about a film or a book or whatever wasn't as good as the first one.
Mm. Every time. I've heard it myself.
Said it myself.
Regularly.
I'm fucking went on blast about Sex and the City 2 for 2 hours, you know?
Yeah.
I mean. And, you know, when I was writing my sequel, I'm sure you were the exact same. I would sit in front of my laptop every day and I would just think to myself, like, okay, let's really boil down what it is people liked about the first one and let me sort of get the raw golden ore, the nugget of what that is, and let me exploit that in a different way with different stakes that are higher and better.
Easily done.
Easily done. And I feel like, in a nice possible way, Helen Fielding just kind of didn't overthink it. She was just kind of like, I'm going to have fun.
Fuck it, I'm going to throw a bunny in there, schizophrenic, stint in Thailand prison.
Yeah. Random Kenyan guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Who really has no bearing on the plot, but is just kind of there for a bit and then fucks off again.
The thing is that when you're writing a sequel, you have to think about the character's emotional arc. How do they grow?
Yeah.
Because with the first book, presumably their growth has ended and you don't have to worry about it. And then if you're writing a sequel, you've got to think about how they're...
Yeah.
So I think Wellington was there for a healthy dose of wisdom, but also commercialism, because he pretends to be very wise, but in the end, he's actually just there to get a jet ski so he can go back to Kenya and live the high life.
I love how it's like this. Bridget's mother has to be doing something mental, right?
Yeah.
So last book it was Julio.
Julio. I love Bridget's mother. She's a fucking brilliant creation.
She's so good.
She's such a great creation.
And like, she was so well played in the movie as well. Just in my head forever now. And like, we all know what it means when someone's a Bridget Jones mother. Yeah. You know, it's such a character of British middle classness that's so easy to conjure. But you know, she had to do something crazy again. So she goes to Kenya and she sort of finds Wellington and brings him back, and the dad is like, oh yeah, Wellington's here. And Bridget's obviously really worried that it's like this incredibly exploitative relationship where
white savior complex.
Yeah.
I can't do that. It's neo-colonialist exactly. Mother.
But then it's like this, it's so kind of great because it's this mutually exploitive relationship.
Yes. And I think this is what Helen Fielding is brilliant about. She writes characters without judgment.
Yeah.
She just writes them how they are.
Yeah.
Flaws and all. Like, no one person is brilliant and flawless. No one person is without prejudice.
Yes.
We're all just really fucking stupid and selfish and kind and empathetic and can be there for one another, but we can also be really, you know, we can ruin relationships. That's what she does so brilliantly.
It's so good. And as well, because like she's almost like she's using that whole thing, the white savior complex storyline, and it's like quite a small subplot really, but this thing of like, oh, the wise Kenyan tribe, and they keep referring to him as a tribesman, and it's just so mental. And then it's like, he's using that idea to get his own sort of stuff. Yes. And it's, and you don't blame him for it.
No.
And the narrative doesn't judge him for it. It's just like, you know.
But that's why it's so brilliant, because it doesn't set any, she doesn't set anyone up as being
particularly noble.
Yeah, yeah. And that's because that's just real life, because people generally have the ability to be great and also dicks.
Yeah. And Wellington, no exception.
No exception.
I think one of my favourite things about this book as well is that I feel like it really engages with the political context of 1997.
Yeah.
Much more than the first book did.
Definitely. And it reminded me about a bit of Sue Townsend in that sense.
Yeah.
Just really,
yeah.
There was a feeling of, I need to say something about the political context we're living in.
Yeah.
Yeah, that really comes across in the book.
Every...
And just the way the social psyche's working as well, with Diana's death and the impact of that on Bridget coming back from Thailand.
I know. Oh my God. Okay, so what are we talking about first? Diana in Thailand or the Labour election?
Labour election.
Okay, because Labour, let me leave that on quickly and then we'll treat ourselves to a nice splashy time with Thailand and Princess Diana's death.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So every general election, somebody tweets this extract from The Edge of Reason, which is Bridget at this Law Society dinner with Darcy and all his friends, and they're all going, they're all mad Tories, obviously, and it's also the first time Bridget realises that Mark Darcy is a Tory.
Brilliant.
So good. She's so horrified, but so briefly.
Yeah, because, I mean, everyone has a right to their own political...
Yeah, I remember a few years ago with this, like, pearl clutching about, oh, you'd never shag a Tory. It's like everyone's shagged a Tory without realizing.
And also, I think eventually everyone becomes a Tory.
Seems like that's
yeah,
the path.
I think that
yeah.
seems, yeah. We all start off as lefties, and by your mid-30s, early 40s, maybe your mid-40s, you're going to be a raging Tory.
Are you heading that
it.
Way? I know you've got a big birthday
I'm
coming up.
I'm not ready
up.
To come out of the closet yet.
She's kind of losing her patience, and she's trying to explain why she's Labour, and she's sort of like, it's this thing, and we've all been in the situation so much of when you're quite lefty and you're at a place where people are more centrist or more right of centre or whatever, and you're just like spouting these general things and you're like, you know.
You have to defend your political beliefs, and then you realise that actually you don't have a very detailed knowledge of your political beliefs.
You're just in favour of general goodness.
Niceness.
just, you know.
Just don't be a dick to people. Like,
don't
give the homeless person a place to live. Is that really too much to ask?
And it feels very like when you're with your own crowd, it feels like, yeah, we're all, these are very simple things. But the thing about particularly young Tories, and I remember getting in this situation a few times as a younger person, a young Tory, because they're so rare and because everyone hates them, they've really done their research. And they're often like very good at doing the, like, you know, well, if you think about
the
this
economic downfall of blah blah
yeah,
blah,
and like,
the 65% increase in blah blah blah.
Yeah. And which, like, And you're just like increasingly uncomfortable. And they're like, well, if you think about it, they'll name some lefty politician of the day. Actually quite right wing and blah, blah, blah.
And what did you think of blah, blah's manifesto? And you're like, sorry, who, what now?
I just would like everyone to eat lunch every day. Yes. And I think that taxes should allow for that.
Yes. And I think we should have a nice NHS, which allows for free healthcare and free education.
And you suddenly feel so naive and tiny.
And really stupid and Bridget-like.
And Bridget-like. But then she gives this rant, and it's I'm going to read from it now. By the way, Prince Andrew's at this dinner, which is mentioned so passingly.
Oh, if only she knew.
Only she knew. Honestly, off they went again, all showing off to each other. Eventually, could stand it no longer. The point is, you are supposed to vote for the principle of the thing, not the itsy-bitsy detail about this percent and that percent. And it is perfectly obvious that Labour stands for the principle of sharing, kindness, gays, single mothers, and Nelson Mandela, as opposed to braying bossy men having affairs with everyone, shag-shag left, shag-shag right, and shag-shag centre, and going to the Ritz in Paris, then telling all the presenters off on the Today programme.
That, I mean, that is fucking genius, isn't it?
It's so good.
She's actually hit upon a very poignant point.
Okay.
Which is, we are so obsessed with details now.
Yeah.
That we miss the bigger picture. Bridget is very wise without realising.
Very wise.
Thick as shit, but also quite wise.
But there's like, obviously it's why Darcy and Bridget should both be running the country together.
Obviously.
Obviously. Yeah.
They'd be such a power couple.
Detail orientated and she's just generally kind.
Yeah. Could do well. They could serve us well.
Oh, it's so good. I love it so much.
I love it so much. I always forget how much I love it until I read it again.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, now I know why I love it so much.
And then when she finishes that rant and she's like, nobody, she says something like, nobody told me to shut up or took the piss like a normal person would. They just all went back to a brief silence and then they resume what they were talking about. And she feels really stupid. And then afterwards, Darcy is with her and somebody else. And I think he says to Rebecca, he's like, oh, she made us all look like a bunch of pricks.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, she did. Yeah,
she did. Because you are all a bunch of pricks.
A bunch of pricks.
Yeah.
Even though you're joining their ranks.
No, not yet. Caroline, I've got a way to go. I'll get there eventually. But not for a while.
This is also where Rebecca makes her big debut. What do you think of Rebecca
Rebecca is
villain?
Amazing, isn't she? Because she basically is every frenemy one has ever had in their life. The agenda-driven, beautiful, status-driven woman who just will throw digs at you. That jellyfish sting thing never rung truer, where it seems like a compliment, but actually it's just a backhanded way of telling you.
Yeah, she's always calling her like vivacious.
Yes.
Like,
you're so full of life, you're such a free spirit.
You're so on the go.
Yes.
Yeah, you're just like a scatty, harebrained bullshit artist.
Which is true.
Yeah.
She doesn't have the right to say it though.
One of my favourite parts of the Rebecca storyline is like when she
ends up with Giles.
Poor, I felt really mad for Giles.
Poor Giles.
There's this whole thing where she's not content with just stealing Mark. She wants to kind of colonise
her friends. Yes.
It's like this really pointed thing. And I love when like Shazza just stands up for it.
Yeah.
Being like, no, we're not going to let her do that. And the way that, like, they just stopped talking to Jude for a while because she invites Rebecca to her wedding.
Yes. Because Bridget is the person that shouldn't be popular and shouldn't be loved. And yet she is, just because she's so kind and nice. And the Rebeccas of the world just can't handle it.
That's it. It is the Nice Girls Finish First book, isn't
it? Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Nice little fantasy to live in. Only in fiction.
Only in fiction. Let's talk about prison.
Let's talk about prison.
So they go to Thailand, and I kind of like almost forgot it was coming, because it's like Bridget moaning for ages that she's not going on holidays this year, and like both her and Shaz are both single and they're like holding out because they both want to go on holidays with a boyfriend, and then they last minute book these flights when they realize they have to go somewhere. And then they have this like time in Thailand taking mushrooms. I love that whole thing of them taking mushrooms.
I love it when she takes the mushrooms and she's like, I was so mesmerised
by my reflection.
That I kept on forgetting that Shazza's having a suicidal meltdown. It's just fucking brilliant.
Just them having like totally separate trips and like Shazza's on the bed just like arriving and she... I feel like I've read it so much that I was there. I can just see Bridget just sitting in front of the mirror.
Just staring at herself. Just... wondering how she came to look like such an angel.
Yeah. And it's like, the thing is, it's like, the thing about them getting drug muled is it would so happen to me.
Yeah.
Everything they do, because like, I kind of forgot the plot machinations of what happens with Jed, the guy that Shaz is shagging.
Mm.
And then their little beach hut gets broken into, all their stuff gets stolen. He's like, oh, you know, you can borrow a few £100 and... have my luggage, and they're very grateful to him, and then obviously he's sewn cocaine into the lining of it, and it's like, oh yeah, and of course, because it looks like a mule situation, especially if he's given them money as well.
Yeah,
like when you kind of think of it as like a thriller plot storyline, it's actually very well plotted.
Yeah,
and I would have totally fallen for every part of it.
Yeah,
and then she's just in a Thai prison for like 11 days.
Yes, where she sings Madonna songs and has to swap her and is actually sexually abused by women.
Yeah.
And it's like, I actually quite enjoyed it because it was nice to feel someone touch me.
Nice to feel touched.
Yes. And I was like, you couldn't put that in a book now, could you? I don't think, even via a character's perspective, I don't think you could. I don't think you could put a lot of what Bridget says and does in a book today, actually.
Yeah. Like,
it's
definitely
very much of its time.
It's of its time. Yeah.
But, yeah, when she sort of has to swap her jeans for a sarong prevent being.
But I'm just so proud of her because she really keeps it together.
It's because of her eternal optimism.
Her eternal optimism!
Things will come right. And the If poem by Rudyard Kipling.
Kipling. She's reads it every day.
Yeah, which I love. Which I actually got a bit teary when I was listening to it.
Oh, I imagine hearing it being read.
It was the woman who was doing Bridget's voice and all the other character voices as well. She was brilliant. So it's worth a listen.
Worth a listen.
Yeah.
And then like she's like the way her the kind of the consulate person who assigned her is rubbish. And she kind of has to sort of stimulate him into getting her out.
Yeah.
It's almost kind of a waste that Mark Darcy sort of saves her from the whole thing because she's doing really well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, she's not set up to be clever enough to get herself out of it.
No,
that's
true.
And Bridge.
Then she gets Liz, she comes home, and I find it really moving, all the sort of the friendship stuff that happens then.
Yeah,
because
that's when they redeem themselves.
They really do.
How shit they were in the beginning.
Just the idea of like coming home from like an ordeal like that and like your friends have changed your sheets and put flowers out and like stocked the fridge with milk tray.
Yeah.
I tried to bring milk tray today, but...
I got celebrations.
I brought celebrations instead.
It's just as good.
Milk tray is such a love language in the Bridget Jones universe, isn't it?
It really is.
And then she's all set for the papers to come out with her.
With her interview.
Yeah.
And then Princess Di dies.
And at first it's quite funny because obviously it's been so long since Diana died. It's almost like a punchline in itself as a global event. And you're like, oh, it would be the day that Diana dies that Bridget's going to be in the paper.
Yeah.
But then actually the narrative really surrenders to mourning Diana.
Yeah, and it does it really in a way that's not twee.
Yeah.
Or saccharine, but just does it it just does it really, really well, melding that comedy with this poignancy, this national grieving, and her personal grieving as well. And I responded to it as a reader.
You really responded to it. It felt really authentic.
Yeah, and that word that I think we both agree should be brought back, how this going to lay flowers down for someone who you don't actually know is pretty naff, but also actually really the thing that you want to do because it just feels right.
Yes.
Even though it's like jumping on a bandwagon. but at the same time you have your personal reasons for it.
And reading her struggle with that is so good. Yeah. And it's like really this thing that we've all experienced, but I've never actually read about before. This thing of the line is it good, is it normal, good thing to do, or just weird?
Or naff
or something. Like Helen Fielding always has such a good compass for what's naff.
She's so clever with that, because I felt that way when we did the NHS clapping every week. I kind of felt like I didn't want to do it because it's a bit naff and like, what does it actually mean? But then also doing it was really nice because everyone on the street, and I was staying with my mum at this time, everyone on our street would come out and we'd all wave to one another, and my mum would get her little drum out and bang that. It was nice at the same time, but it was also slightly uncomfortable. Helen Fielding plays with that really well.
She really does. And like that whole sort of tussle with the self, and the way you there's a line where she's like, why do I live in a capital city if not to participate in these outpourings of national feeling? And I've felt that so many times when various things have happened in London, whether it's a protest or I really welled up when she goes, and she brings
a copy of Vogue and what else? A chocolate orange. Caroline, by the way, listeners, is now tearing up in my living room. I'm not quite sure what to do.
You're so uncomfortable.
I'm so uncomfortable with this display of emotion. She's being so Irish right now. And me, counter to my Pakistani heritage, and being very English.
No, okay. It's because the way she says it's like, oh, they ran out of flowers, but so I bought her Vogue instead. And then because she quite liked Vogue.
Yeah, because she quite liked Vogue.
And it's this thing of like, she really feels like she knows her. And the way she talks about her in her diary is very like, she kind of says like, oh, you know, we weren't good enough for her, which is the sort of like very Englishy of, oh, our fallen angel. But then she's, you know, she's very much like she really talks about what it meant to be a woman in your 30s who is single, and then to have Princess Diana to be in her 30s and a single mother and dating Dodi and all that stuff. And there's this line where she says, you know, Diana understood that your life isn't supposed to be a fairy tale, and she sorted out her own problems, and you really get this sense of this patron saintage that makes total sense.
Yeah, it was very affecting, and it was really well written and really well done, and you just love Bridget Moore for it.
Yeah,
and you miss Diana for it as well.
Yeah, I was too young when she died, really, and, you know, too Irish to care that much. But I really cared this time around.
There we are.
I was going to read a quote from that passage, but I think I'd cry again and you get uncomfortable.
But Don't do that.
Look, I've come off this like podcasting series with Dolly where she's really pulling it out of me and she's really encouraging it. She's a pervert for tears. Now I'm here and you're like, stop
cut
it.
Cut that emotion.
Shit out, Caroline.
We don't deal with that.
Okay, can I say one line that I liked?
Yes, go on then.
Okay, it's very short. Where they're talking about all these unlikely things that have happened because Rebecca and Giles have got together, and it's a couple of days after the funeral for Lady Di, and she's like, bats will start eating the sun, I expanded. Horses will be born with tails on their heads, and cubes of frozen urine will land on our roof terrace offering us cigarettes. And then Shan says, and Princess Diana is dead.
That is brilliant timing.
Brilliant.
Brilliant timing. She's a fucking genius.
Oh, she's so good.
She's so good.
Because the thing is, I've been doing this podcast for a while now, as you know. I haven't been here at the very beginning. And I've kind of built up this thing in my head because there are so many overlooked female authors in this genre. And I'm like, you know what? Helen Fielding was great, but there are lots of people who were as good as her. They just didn't get the attention because Helen Fielding had this huge profile with her journalism and blah, 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 blah.
Who might that be? Can you think of anyone?
Here's the thing, I'm wrong.
There we are.
Here's the thing, I'm fucking wrong. She's the queen.
Yeah, she's actually the queen. And every time I read Bridget Jones, and it's on a regular basis, right, I just remember that why she's the queen.
Yeah.
Because no one gets it as astutely as her.
I just think her and Sue Townsend are the greatest female. No, female. What the fuck are we talking? They're the greatest comic novelists of the last 100 years. Like, it's like Wodehouse.
Yes.
Muriel Spark. Townsend.
Yeah.
Fielding. Like, that's it. It's so and the thing is, like, getting back into this book, and I've read the first book a lot, but I haven't read this one that much. So it was really refreshing to have bits I wasn't as familiar with. Being on like page one of this book and being right back in the tone of how the very particular way that Bridget writes to herself, of like referring to herself as one and like must do this, must do better, blah, blah, blah. It's like so specific and it's impossible to imitate, even though it seems like it would be easy to, you know?
Yeah. I also, I love the fact that she's only 9 stones and 3 pounds and thinks that she needs to lose 20 pounds. Kind of actually made me a little bit sick.
Yeah, it really sucks. Yeah. It's the only thing I don't like about these books. Because the thing is that she smokes a lot and she drinks a lot. She smokes more than I do and she drinks more than I do. But those numbers never affect me. But when I see 9 stone 2 and then brackets, and like, I haven't been 9 stone since I was 11.
I always remembered Bridget to actually be a little bit fat. So when I read those figures, and this was a while ago, I was like, what? This is...
Every time it's a shock, isn't it?
Yeah,
It must be even worse when you're...
Thick thighs are in now, so...
Yeah, I know!
Hooray for that.
That's another thing, like, reading this and books like it that are set in this time period, where people are always talking about like pert little bottoms.
A pert little bottom.
Yeah, snooker ball arse. No. Like, nobody wants a snooker ball arse. No.
The wider the better.
Yeah, I'm so glad that we're living in an era of big arses.
Although, having said that, most people who like big arses also want really teeny tiny Kim Kardashian waists, but we won't talk about that.
We don't talk about them. They have no place on this podcast.
Absolutely not. I feel like I should have had a notebook when I was reading or listening to it, because
Oh my God, we haven't even talked about Colin Firth.
Can you? Oh, the Colin Firth interview, which via Audible, by the way, went on forever, and I actually got annoyed with Bridget. I was like, "Come the fuck on, Bridget! Sort your shit out."
How did she do Colin Firth's voice? Just Poshman voice?
Yeah, basically Mr. Darcy.
Oh my God. Yeah. Oh my God. So it goes on for pages and pages.
For so long. It was very funny.
And it's also, as a journalist, as someone who's like done celebrity interviews, it really tracks how it gets set up. Like, she really pays attention to detail.
Helen Fielding was a journalist as well. Yeah. Right? So she knew the dynamics of how that would...
That thing of like the Independent, like she gets it through a friend of Tom's, right? So it's a friend of a friend, it's all journalism works. And then some other friend of a friend worked with Colin on Fever Pitch, and so they kind of get in as long as she agrees not to be paid.
Classic.
And they fly her to Rome, which that would never happen now because publishing budgets. And she fannies about not writing up the interview for so long.
She misses the flight. She
misses the flight first.
She's such a dick, isn't she? I got annoyed with her. I was like, get your shit together, Bridget.
Oh, God.
Just do your job. Get your life together.
I hate anything that's racing against the clock in the film. God,
it really...
Yeah.
Oh, just... I can't stand it.
Very difficult.
It's my pet peeve. People who are always late.
Yeah, I can't stand it. Yeah. And people always expect me to be late and then they fuck around with me. Lateness.
Why would they do that?
I think they think because Irish people are flaky.
There's a stereotype for you.
Which we are, but I'm very on time.
Same for Pakistanis, right? We're always late.
Is that a thing?
Yes, it's a proper thing. Oh, Pakistanis. It's a Pakistani wedding, so it says 6, but we'll get there for 8.
Oh my God.
Another thing we have in common.
Another thing!
Look at all these things we keep finding
out. We should write a book together.
We should.
Aimed at 2 very specific demographics.
People would love it.
People would love it. But the thing where... Have you interviewed people before? Have you ever done journalism?
No, not really. I've chaired events, but that's not the same thing.
But there is the thing where, like, every interview you've ever read in a magazine and where it's like, haha, and, you know, Colin gestures to the waiter and we smile at each other and all this thing, because all journalists are fundamentally nerds who want to be liked. Everyone constructs a profile as if...
There's a sweeping statement for you all.
And I can say this because I used to be one. All journalists are nerds who desperately want to be liked, especially journalists who interview people. It's like, unless they're the 2% of like people who are like chasing down politicians in Westminster trying to get like the facts on the stories.
Right.
We just want celebrities to fall in love with us. And you can hear me doing many versions of that on this podcast. Go back and listen to my Rose McGowan episode. But you, everyone constructs their profile as if it's like, oh, here's my great friend, Judi Dench, and we just got on like a house on fire, and her cheeky laugh and all this, and she laughs at my jokes and blah, blah. But the reality is that everyone's raw file, raw transcript, actually reads almost exactly like her interview.
Oh, really?
Okay, maybe no one asks, you know, Colin Firth what his favourite colour is.
Shocking.
But the way she opens every subject with, do you know BBC Pride and Prejudice? And do you know Fever Pitch? Every project she asks him about, she says, do you know?
That is a great scene, isn't it?
It's so funny.
It's so funny.
And she just keeps asking him about the scene where she jumps in the lake.
Yeah.
BBC Pride and Prejudice.
And how... I didn't find it believable that they would print the transcript, though, in The Independent. Yeah. That was kind of slightly far-fetched.
But then, remember a few years ago when... I think it was OK or Now magazine or one of them. They interviewed Gemma Collins about her book. And the PR hadn't supplied the book to...
Do you remember that?
Hadn't supplied the book to the journalist. And the journalist kind of came in being like, hi, Gemma. Haven't read the book. Didn't get it in time. Let's talk about your career. And Gemma Collins was really offended by this and just sort of like chewed it up and spat him out. And they printed the whole transcript because it was so mental. Yeah.
That's brilliant. Oh, well, I guess it does happen.
I guess it happens sometimes when it's very, very funny, which... Yeah. This was.
Yeah, this was very funny. Although at one point I was like, you are an actual idiot, Bridget Jones. An actual idiot.
I love, though, how, like, obviously Helen Fielding is clearly a fan of Colin Firth because she wrote him to be so dreamy.
Yes.
When he actually appears in the text.
Yeah. Do you think that she's the one who got him to be in the film?
I don't know. Because I remember on the Edge of Reason film DVD extras, there was... but it was very much like Mark Darcy went home and Colin Firth stayed behind and they made Bridget interview him.
Oh, right. It's a shit film, isn't it? The second one.
It's shit, yeah.
The first one's brilliant. Work of art.
Work of art. And I actually have a lot of affection for the third one.
Oh, yeah, the third one wasn't bad. I didn't love it like I loved the first one, but it was best than the second one.
It felt very Mamma Mia, here we go again. Like, yes. It's very much for the fans. It's a fun time. It's a bit more... fancier and glossier than the first movie.
But I can't remember. We've gone off topic.
Are you too hungry and you want to go to lunch?
Well, kind of. A little bit that. A little bit still fancy Colin Firth.
Still,
yeah. Even though he's now just quite...
110.
Yeah, basically quite old. Quite like old men, though. I think this is a different conversation now.
There's one thing I want to talk about, because I sent it to you in a voice note last night, and then you didn't respond, very rudely.
Oh, sorry, what was that again? the Richard Curtis thing.
Okay, so, as eagle-eyed fans will know, Helen Fielding is the godparent, godmother of Scarlett Curtis, Richard Curtis's daughter. Hello, Scarlett, have you listened? This feels like the kind of podcast you would listen to. You seem like a cool girl. And in the book, Bridget's goddaughter is Constance, who's 3. Now, I did the maths.
She was very serious about this.
I went and I looked at when she would have written this, which would have been 96. No, she would have written in 98, right?
Oh, yeah.
If it's set in 97. Yeah. And it came out in 99.
Right.
So... Scarlett Curtis was born in 95. So Scarlett would have been the same age as Constance, this figure in the book, who's 3. So we can safely assume...
Safely assume? Just like every author writes the main character as themselves.
It's so horrible because I have such a go at people when they think that my characters are from life. And then I'm like, oh, Constance is Scarlett Curtis.
But Helen Fielding did say that Shazza was based on a friend of hers, didn't she? I'm pretty sure I read that somewhere. I know that from somewhere.
Oh.
Yeah.
I believe that, yeah.
But I don't think Helen Fielding and Richard Curtis talk anymore. They fell out. Yes.
How do you know that?
Because I don't know, I read it somewhere, or I was listening to a podcast or something or another, but they fell out over after the second film.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I'm really sorry to tell you that.
I hope Helen and Scarlett are still close.
I mean, I don't know. Sorry to break your heart. Don't start crying again.
When I walked in here today, one of the first things you said to me was, friendship groups aren't a thing.
Friendship groups are not a thing. They're not a thing. They don't last. They have an expiry date.
Yeah.
You show me one friendship group from teens or their 20s who have lasted for the decade.
Without massively resenting one another.
Yes, exactly. I just don't believe it. Maybe, I just don't believe it.
I agree. I like it. Yeah. As someone who has very little contact with most of the childhood friends,
I don't have any childhood friends.
You're very old.
I also don't have many friends, so that might have something to do with it.
I'm your friend. Okay, we're going to wrap up. But do we have anything left to say about The Edge of Reason?
It's brilliant. If you haven't read it, read it.
What's your favourite joke?
My favourite? There are so many, but although the Oxfam joke where she starts throwing away her self-help books. The screenshot you sent me yesterday. When I listened to that, I actually was lolling for ages.
It was so funny.
Shall I read it out?
Yeah.
The paragraph.
Yeah, I think I screen grabbed it and sent you last night.
You did. So she, in a fit of trying to find a sense of self and not let self-help books ruin her relationships, Bridget Jones decides to throw all her self-help books away and give, so she says, right, all going in the bin plus the other 32, oh God though, cannot bear to throw out the road less travelled and you can heal your life. Where else is one to turn for spiritual guidance to deal with problems of modern age if not self-help books? Islam, obviously, Bridget. Also, maybe should give to Oxfam, but no, must not ruin relationships of others, especially in third world, would be worse than behaviour of tobacco giants. That's fucking brilliant.
Such a funny image. I can't handle it.
It's so funny.
The idea of like women in like Sudan or something just picking up women from Mars. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus.
Yeah.
And just destroying their relationships because Bridget gave them to Oxfam.
I mean, she's so fucking thick, isn't she? But hilarious.
She's so good. Do you think people were quite mean about this book when it came out?
Were they?
Well, no, I read a piece in, I think it was The Guardian from the time, of being like, aren't we all so fucking sick of this annoying marketing campaign? And apparently, I find this very glamorous, there was Silkcut handed out at the launch party.
Ooh.
I find that so hot.
That is very sexy.
Love that.
Yeah. It wouldn't happen now, though, would it?
No, absolutely. Anything being handed out at a launch party that isn't a fucking sticker and a proof.
Or a tote bag.
Or woof. Okay, I've been Kenya Dunhu. You've been H. Malik.
I have been.
Tell me about your stuff so these people can buy it.
Oh, so I wrote a Muslim Bridget Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Not as funny as Helen Fielding.
Oh, just as funny.
Well, I mean,
there's a different kind of hole in the wall in that one.
There is a different, which is why I enjoyed the hole in the wall in this book so much. And also have written a couple of children's books now.
My latest one is a very beautiful one in front of me.
Seven Sisters, out last week.
It's gorgeous.
And each of the characters are named after a niece or a godchild. You see, Lola, my goddaughter, is the minority in it because she's the only white girl. There she is.
I see her with her bob. Her sensible bob.
My last book was This Green and Pleasant Land.
Which is so good.
Thank you. Another hole, but not in the wall. In the ground.
I love holes.
I do love holes.
Oh my God. Yeah, This Green and Pleasant Land, very, very good book about a very funny book as well, about a young Muslim man who has a crisis of identity and then tries to build a mosque in his conservative British town.
Yes.
So good.
Thank you. That's all I've done.
Yeah, and you've got a new one coming, I think.
Yes, The Movement, which isn't out until next year.
But everyone look out for it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
It's all about shutting the fuck up.
Yes, it is about shutting the fuck up. And I remember when you were researching for that, you shut the fuck up for like a month, right?
A week. A month. Okay, I've just taken it a bit far, love. Yes, I did. I went silent for a week to see how it would feel to not converse with anyone or communicate verbally with anyone. It was great, actually. And then the pandemic happened and I was like, actually.
Yeah, you were really tempting fate there, weren't you?
Yes, I did.
All right, well, that's lots of things for everyone to look out for and to buy. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to talk about Bridget Jones.
Always. Let's have lunch.
Okay.
At 192.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's C-Z-A-R-O-L-I-N-E, or email me about the podcast at sentimentalpod@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thank you to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the artwork, and Hannah Varro for the mixing.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.